And a double play ball that could end it, but Lindor boots it, and they'll get no outs. Looked like an inning-ending double play.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Monday, July the 13th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And come join me at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to the All-Star break here at the Talking Mets podcast. And I think for many of you, mercifully, it's the All-Star break. Got a lot to talk about here at the historical midway point of the season, a chance to take a blow for 3 days. Normally, you take a chance to take a blow before you gear up for the dog days of August and go get it done and potentially postseason baseball. That won't be the case for the 2026 Mets. 17 games under 500. Worst first half I read since 1995. A little historical perspective there. And I saw some comments on social media that how embarrassing this is, and at least, you know, that team in 95 wasn't expected to win. That's actually wrong. The 95 Mets were a team that had some veterans going into that year that had some momentum before the strike in 94. I think there were only a couple of games under 500. And at that point, you had Jeff Kent in the meat of prime of his career. You had Rico Bronya emerging. You had Brett Saberhagen, John Franco, Bobby Bonilla. They brought in Brett Butler. At that point, I think David Segee, who was a decent veteran bat, was on that team, and a young player like Todd Hundley. And that was before the Generation K kids, but they were coming, and the Mets were expected to not be as bad as they were in that first half. Led to a sell-off, Saberhagen gone, Brett Butler gone, Bonilla gone. And they wound up having, with the Generation K kids, and Carl Everett was brought up, Ryan Thompson, who was on this show just a few weeks ago. They wound up having one of the best records in the National League in the second half, and a lot of hope and momentum going into 96. Obviously, with Isringhausen, Pulsifer, and then Paul Wilson leading the way, they wound up getting Lance Johnson and Bernard Gilkey over the offseason. Long and short, you know what happened, Generation K, which ultimately led to the Bobby Valentine era, an era that we just celebrated at the end of May, and an era that, as I always say, I cut my baseball teeth on. So, little historical perspective, getting you started, getting you warmed up here on the Sunday. A lot to talk about. Obviously, Francisco Lindor and what we saw in the ninth inning is going to be a big conversation. Zach Thornton and the future of the staff, Clay Holmes, and potentially bringing Clay Holmes back. During the mailbag, got a little bit of commentary from a professional scout that I'll share, who knows a little bit about some of the Mets' top draft picks. Get to your comments, and then really set up what will be, and this is what this show is all about, set up the trade deadline and the focus of the deadline, and really set straight, because I think over the next two and a half weeks, you're going to be fed a lot of information from the media, a lot of educated speculation, a lot of gaslighting, a lot of gifting that they're going to expect the Mets to do to their favorite teams, typically the Yankees and the Braves and the Dodgers and teams like that, so that they could see their favorite teams get fortified down the stretch. You're going to see a lot of media nonsense. Know who you could trust. Know what information is good. Know what's speculation. Know what's gaslighting. Know what just simply is Mets for clicks, because that's out there too. So here's what we know, and let's set it all up here. We know what we saw at Citi Field yesterday was probably a synopsis of the 2026 season, the best and the worst. All good vibes through eight innings. Zach Thornton, Luke Weaver. Not a lot of offense, but the Red Sox are one of the top five pitching teams in baseball. It's not a surprise that the Mets had some trouble scoring. What you saw in the ninth inning, the egregious error by Lindor, clumsy error, something that we've seen from him a lot over the last couple of years. Devin Williams, and a reminder of how fortunate we all were since, let's say 2020, not 2019, because it was a rough intro, fortunate to Edwin Diaz, and how fickle the closing position is, how fickle the closing position is here in New York, and how rare it is to have the experience that we all had with Edwin Diaz. And then obviously the disappointment of not getting it done in extra innings and what have you. But the Mets, from all the information, despite all the bad vibes, and I mean, that's a symbolically terrible loss. That loss symbolized every bit of frustration and how I feel about the first half of the 2026 season. This is not a trash team that's hopeless. This is a team, as Andy Green had indicated, that has had some bad fortune, mainly brought out by their bad execution, and they just never got that 12-game losing streak. Just set the tone for the season. Yeah, you have the injuries, you have the pitching that has really, because of the starters again this year, not giving you length, has collapsed towards the bottom third of the league. You've got veterans that have disappointed, that again, after last year, have not stepped up. Kodai Senga, David Peterson, who's no longer with us at this point, and then the imports who have been injured and disappointing, the Luis Robert Jr., the Polancos, and of course the kids. We've talked about them over and over and over again, that, you know, now Vientos is hurt, but Beatty, who, you know, short stretches, but doesn't seem to really give you an indication he's an everyday player, especially because, you know, he's got about 1,300 big league at-bats. At this point, you're going to kind of figure out he is who he is. I was once told 1,500 at-bats is what a player needs to settle into who they are. And the same thing a little bit with Alvarez, who's had injuries. So you kind of have all that in play. But what we do know is this from credible sources, not from Michael Kay, not from Mike Francesa, okay, that just want to try to get people, particularly with Francesa, to listen to him on his new medium, that the Mets are not looking to tear this down. I'm not saying they're not listening on any kind of trades. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that nobody is available. Everybody's available for the right price. Somebody calls up David Stearns over the All-Star break and says, I got a deal for you, and it's too good to pass up. Things change. But the intent of this front office, and Cohen talked about it, yes, they have a bit of a payroll bloat going into next year. Their intent is to try to have a team that, I'm not saying will have championship aspirations, because how can you even talk about that after the last couple of years? But a team that's going to compete and be part of the muck of wild card at this time next year, at the very least. At the very least. And it's going to get harder. They're in a division that's getting harder. The Braves have always found a way, and they still have really good in-prime players. The Phillies get a little older, but team that knows how to win. And then you have two emerging young teams, the Nats and the Marlins, that are starting to figure it out, that for many, many years you were able to feast on. Now you got to fight within the division every night when you look at that group. And a good manager down in D.C., in Drew Butera, and a front office in Miami that came from Tampa that has a pretty good history of doing more with less. And essentially, they might become the National League version of the Rays, which is a big problem for the Mets. So a rebuild, look, in all normal world, a rebuild might be something that you could consider and tear this down for 5 years. The owner's not interested in doing that leading into the casino. The owner's not interested in doing that when he wants to have what he saw probably at Madison Square Garden a month ago, the kind of clientele and excitement and energy and high net worth type of fan at the ballpark. So you have an edict here, and a general manager who has 2 years on his contract, or he's going to lose his job and potentially be smeared from ever really having a significant role in baseball again. All that together means they want to compete. So we'll start and end with what's on your mind, which is Lindor. And I know you're angry with Lindor, and you're disappointed with Lindor. And I saw the play, It's not an easy play, but a professional shortstop should at least get a force play on that. At least should get a force play on that. And probably a good infield maybe turns a double play. And Devin Williams gets out of the ballgame. Zach Thornton gets a win. And we all go home happy. And unfortunately, right now, and the shame of it is you cost the kid his first big league win. That's the shame of it is. And Lindor takes accountability. He always does. But the fans don't want to hear accountability. They don't want to hear it's unacceptable. That's baseline. That's what you, out of a player who's highly paid, arguably people have said he's the captain, arguably the best player on the team. He's not, Soto is, but both ways on the ball. When he's on, he's the best two-way player on the team. That's a baseline. And I think the bigger question, because as they've started to get healthy, the Mets, as Ewing and Benj have incorporated themselves into the roster, you've started to wonder, and I at least going into this weekend, well, are they starting to build an offense that at least with Soto, Benj, Ewing, and Lindor, assuming that you still get a couple of years of him, 2 to 3 years of him being in the top 10 to 15 positional players in baseball, with that core, and then figuring out the other four spots with some combination of catch and throw defense, and really, you're probably one impact bat short. I know what people are going to say, there's Pete Alonso, but I think Stearns was looking for an impact bat that's not just impact for the next couple of years at Alonso's price, but maybe a little bit longer. You're at a point where maybe you got something there. So you start to look at the offense, and the offense was, if you count the 12 runs against Kansas City, was averaging over 5 runs a game. Now, Boston, you take that out, and you factor in Boston, and they're pitching this weekend, you're down to where you've pretty much been all year, 4.3, 4.4, 4.5, when you look at the July numbers. Just, you can run them yourselves. I ran them before the show. Which is a below league average to league average offense. For the offense to really be good, you need to be about 4.8, and you want to be part of the contending conversation, a consistent win, you got to be around 5. You got to be about 5 runs a game. I mean, Pirates are up there at the top of baseball in runs scored. They're not even dealing with a big budget at that point. You can do it. There's a way with the core stars, and assuming Benj and Ewing are for real, and I think they are, you can do it. But it becomes more complicated when you see what you've seen from Lindor. Now, Lindor, and I said this last week, and I'll say this again, Lindor can't be graded on simply the whole season for what it's worth. When you have the have the spring training truncated and the surgery and the rush back, and again, you get on the field and you say you're healthy, you play, right? Which led to, I believe, his calf injury. I think the rushing back from spring training led to his calf injury. And you want to blame anything with his regimen off season, that I can't speak for. But when you get off to that kind of start, your spring training gets truncated, you have a pretty, not a serious surgery, but a surgery that impacts a significant part of your body that helps you hit. You have the calf injury. You get shut down, essentially, from all baseball activities. And now, almost halfway through the season, you're back. He's not really getting any flow. And there's no data point that indicates he's been good. I mean, he's got an OPS slightly over 700 for the month of July. And defensively, going back to last year, he's been disappointing. And it's not because the eye test, and I haven't even brought up any advanced metrics. Maybe I will before the show's over. But I got to go. Fielding to me is so much about the eye test, and then you go to the advanced metrics. I don't see a misstep. I see clumsy. Like what you saw on Sunday was clumsiness, was rushing, was almost a mental thing. I mean, what was it? So many times last year, the ball on line drives just pop out of his glove. He would just miss it. I don't know if it's a range thing. It's almost like, and maybe it is reaction time as an age thing. It just seems like he's off. And I don't think there's anything I see with the eye that says, well, that's a declining defensive player. Really, that's my opinion. If you think differently, I'd like to hear from you. I really would. And the position, the premium position he plays, the bat, and even with his current production, which is very little, you're looking at a 2.8 to 3 WAR player, according to Fangraphs, if you extrapolate it over a full season. Now, going forward, do I believe Lindor, as he gets into his late prime and then mid-30s, can do what he did in 2022, 2023, and would have done if not for his back in 24? And that's a key point. We really don't know that back injury that he had in 24 late in the year. We don't know what that's going to do to him. What if that was just a tweak, or that was the beginning or a harbinger of things to come? But the days of him playing 160 games at that demanding position and the Mets not having even on the roster somebody that could cover acceptably a couple of innings are over. I mean, think about it. There are times you look at the Mets' construction of their roster. This is before Stearns. There wasn't much other shortstop action. I mean, McNeil. Because the guy played every inning. The guy played in blowouts. The guy never came out for the most part. Those days are over. And that's okay. I mean, that happens. I mean, there's no reason why he can't DH at times. There's no reason why he has to play in a blowout. There's no reason why he can't get a day off. And the Mets should still be able to win. Now, that's the big question. Because going into 27 and competing in 27 and maximizing the first 5 years and maybe the best 5 years of the Soto contract and maximizing the young and expensive years of Benjamin Ewing really is predicated on Lindor still having something. And I'm not saying he's going to be 2024 Lindor or vintage Lindor from who you signed that, you know, was an MVP candidate. Maybe he's a very good all-star. Maybe a little bit more inconsistent. Maybe the glove isn't quite as good. That's still a really good player. That's disappointing because you like to see if there's juice left in there. One or two more seasons of elite Lindor. Because he's this athletic guy. He doesn't look come across old. Yeah, he's getting into his 30s. And and shortstops don't necessarily, physically. You know, you saw it even with Jeter. They start to take that step back. Jeter's bat never did. After he started having those serious injuries late in his career, then it was a different story. And there's some, maybe we got to look at some Cal Ripken / those data. I mean, I'm sure there's data with the great shortstops, the Trammels, the Ripkins. I think I ran this at some point over on the Substack, the Premium. There's probably some concern that the beginning of the decline is here. But I don't think you're in the heavy part of the decline. And I don't think yesterday is a reason to overreact. Now, what yesterday is going to do, and we talked about it, and I reacted to Francesa's podcast. And let me just say this. I'm not going to, because the Premium people already heard this. I'm not getting into this again. Last week, you had two major voices in New York sports. One that's on his own platform, on a podcast. The other that works for ESPN Radio. Give bad information on the air. Information that contradicted hardworking, everyday, well-sourced, credible, proven credibility journalists like Will Salmon at The Athletic. Contradicted on the air, and then one had to backtrack in K with the Anthony Volpe story, and then admitted, "Oh, I got bad information." Basically, it was a lie, or it was information that he intentionally manipulated to paint a certain story. And Francesa, I don't know who he's talking to. I'm not saying he doesn't have context in the industry. He took industry educated speculation to a level of certainty that only he can do, and really set a firestorm. Now, I know they asked Lindor after the game, would you waive your no-trade clause? And let me explain something to you. This is on a tee for the media to make this something they could drag out for 2 weeks because they're going to need content in a season that's going nowhere. And there's a portion of the meeting that's praying. They got their Joe Booze out. They're Joe Boos. They go, you could get a Joe Boo. You got your Major League Joe Boos out praying that he could be gifted to the Yankees. And not only gifted to the Yankees for no prospect capital, Mets will pay the privilege to watch him across town. They would love that. I mean, because when you look at it, I don't see a world where, unless it's a salary dump, and I have a hard time believing, because what will have to happen is similar to the Scherzer-Verlander scenario where you'd have to take on salary for a top prospect. And I don't think the Yankees have anything they'd be willing to give, even if the Mets picked up a third of the contract or 20% of the contract. The Mets would have to pay to get out of that contract. And you would only do that if you think the guy is completely done. And you would then have to sit here, especially the case if it's the Yankees, and watch him have some level. Because I don't think he's done. I think next year he comes into spring training. I think with a normal spring training, a healthy spring training, I think you pretty much see the Lindor that you expect. Now, does that mean what we see? And the biggest question mark is what we see on defense and what happened yesterday in the ninth inning is something that will happen more frequently. Are we not going to see the same range? Are we going to see bigger peaks and valleys as you hit certain points of the summer? Are you going to have more DH days / days off? I mean, all that's true. That doesn't mean he's not an all-star type player. I mean, heck, even Mookie Betts, who plays all around the field, has shown his age over in L.A. Doesn't mean you're done. Doesn't mean you don't have some value. Look, a three-war player of Lindor's at shortstop, when you start to look at the... forget the fact that the Mets have nothing to replace him with. I mean, nothing. I mean, you're looking at glove-first, borderline 4A type guys that replace Lindor. Look, you have a glove behind the plate in Torrens that may be a guy that if you move, and the metrics on Alvarez at DH are held a lot better behind the plate, you might make him your catcher because of his defense. And at the very least, going into next year, you're going to have a glove-first veteran at second in Simeon. It's already two parts of your lineup, that offense you're sacrificing for glove, which isn't the end of the world. But when you have a lineup that's 5-6 deep, 7 deep, is a lot different than 5 or 6 or 6 or 7 deep. Then and one of those bats, one of those positions, you're kind of playing component-driven with first base. You can't survive with a third glove first guy. And I don't know where you go. I mean, unless you believe in Ronnie Mauricio, and I don't see anything about Ronnie Mauricio's game that indicates that he can take that prodigious body and talent and power that you see in AAA, and you probably see if you went out at 5 o'clock for batting practice, and turn it into any kind of consistency. It just hasn't happened. He has no recognition of the strike zone. He just doesn't seem like a player that gets the game and how complicated it is between the ears. And then you say, well, Mike, they could always go out and get someone on the free agent market. Why, J.P. Crawford, that's your best shortstop. Ha Sung Kim, that's on the free agent market. Connor Falafa. Kyle Farmer. Not a lot. So I don't see a world where it makes sense to trade Lindor. Now, you want to get this payroll manageable and you have a plan to take a step back. And legit, I know Billy Epler talked about taking a step back. And a lot of people forget when Stearns came in, Epler had already told Scherzer and Verlander that 24 was kind of a gap year. And then it turned into this crazy summer. And everybody said, well, he was handed an NLCS team. That's not what the conversation was a year in July, the end of July with Scherzer and Verlander, unless they were lying. I think things kind of came together. And when they had the opportunity, they seized it, but I don't think they believed. I think what you see this year is what they expected in 24, and 24 kind of stopped it. And then adding Soto, they went for the gut jugular, thinking I had more here than I thought. And then we know what happened. So unless they're, and it would have to be a situation where if the Mets are paying any of this salary, they have to get themselves a legit prospect. Because if you're just going to pay to get him out of here like you did for a maybe prospect like Acuna, Ryan Clifford, Drew Gilbert, I mean, come on. You can't do that for a Hall of Famer. Scherzer was at the end of the line. Verlander was at the end of the line. They were not Lindor in terms of their standing in the ballgame. I mean, maybe you could say Scherzer was still elite when they signed him, but they're also pitchers at the end of their career. Lindor, in addition to the fact that he's got 5 years left on his deal, and let me just make sure I got that right, because I always have that. Yeah, he signed till 2031. He's still coming off a period where he's a top 10 to 15 player in the sport at a premium position. Those don't grow on trees. So I don't see where any of this conversation makes sense. And there's only so many teams. I mean, and I went through this exercise, I believe, on the premium side. I might have even brought it up last week. But when you look at Kansas City, no, Miami, Cincinnati, let's just look at the his old team. Actually, they have a shortstop, Brian Rocchio, one of the top five shortstop in the league right now. Chicago's got Swanson. Arizona's got Perdomo. Gunnar Henderson in Baltimore. Colson Montgomery with the White Sox. Houston's got Jeremy Peña. They already got Bogarts out in San Diego. Seattle's got J.P. Crawford. You want to switch there? I'm telling you, this is a Braves, Yankees, you know, maybe even Dodgers scenario. And I'm not interested in seeing the Mets gift to those teams. They want them, they got to pay for them and give a prospect. Now, somebody wants to do that, then maybe you have a conversation. Does Lindor, who has 10 and 5 rights now, want to go across town? I mean, would he approve a trade to the Dodgers or the Yankees? Or maybe, I don't know about the Braves. I could see it. I could see it. But it's either salary relief or prospects. And I don't know if either of those make me, I mean, does Cohen want the salary relief that badly? Knock $30 million off the payroll? Is there something more to that? Because of the fictitious Lindor-Soto situation, getting Lindor out of there is all of a sudden going to make everything hunky-dory? Where are you going to get that production? You know, if Soto wants to win, and part of him even getting his numbers for the Hall of Fame is being in some kind of competent lineup, you're going to need players, and Lindor is one of those guys. I don't know what world this is even a story. Unless he wants out, and I did not see a guy post-game that looked like he wants out. So I know we'll talk about it, and maybe there'll be some more smoke to this, some more fire and smoke. According to what the reports out there are, the Mets aren't interested in any kind of teardown. They're interested in trading guys who are replaceable, i.e. relievers at the deadline. And if you want to get one of their controllable guys, a Weaver, let's just say there, or a young player like an Alvarez, then you're going to have to pay. And we'll see how many people want to pay for that. Clay Holmes, guys like that. I don't know what they're going to get. They might get as much for Manaea Peralta as they get for Manaea. And we'll get to the rotation after the break. So, to me, right now, one of the things to look for as we head to the back half of the year, and what kind of happens in these seasons, there's the getting to know you phase, what does this team need phase, which in a season where you're not contending, you kind of look at what does this team needs either to rebuild or go into next year. We've been talking about that. They need some kind of bats in that farm system. And then the calendar flips post-deadline and you look towards 27 and it's almost like you're starting extended spring training early. So it's a little bit of a different kind of phases we have here for this particular squad, this particular season. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Zach Thornton didn't get his first big league win, but he impressed again. Let's talk about him. Let's talk about the rotation. Let's talk about that in context of Clay Holmes, because if you want to hang your hat on hope, starting pitching and what this rotation could look like and the youth and the upside could be reason that there's some hope here. And it's not all negativity. It's not all hopeless. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
So, Zach Thornton, you see the numbers this year. 4.02 ERA between AA and AAA. Cutter is his best pitch. He threw it about one-third of the time in the minor leagues. He's upped it, though, in the major leagues.
And Rafael swings and misses, but Torrens has to chase it down and throws him out. Nicely done by Torrens. And Eaton goes after a high heater. And Thornton's got his second strikeout. Great start for Zach. 2-2. And he got him with a breaking ball. Good sweeper by Thornton to strike out Duran for the second out. Swing and a miss, and Rafaela down on strikes. That's four Ks for Thornton, two out of the sixth. And he goes down swinging on the cutter. Five strikeouts for Thornton, two down in the seventh. And Duran hits a soft ground ball for short, and that retires the side. Zach Thornton with seven scoreless innings. Tremendous effort in his third big league start for Zach Thornton, the 24-year-old from Grand Canyon.
All right, we're back. One last thing on Lindor. If you want to look at the farm system and take Mauricio out of it, unless you believe Mitch Voit is close, and he's in Brooklyn right now, and there's Wandy Usigan, top 10 prospect, rookie ball. And then if you go further down, you got Antonio Jimenez down in A ball. There's nothing. I mean, you trade Lindor, you better have a plan. And it better not be Ronnie Mauricio. You want to say it's Bo Bichette? Look young, big hitter. There's a reason why they, and with his knee right now, taking a couple of days off, I don't even know if, I think third base might be the only position outside of DH that a guy with a knee history can play. You don't want rangy positions. You don't want a guy with some limitations physically. I think he's a corner guy and a DH. I think that's what Bo Bichette's future is. So, and he's where he should be defensively, at a position that you could, which I don't think he's that bad at, to tell you the truth, when I've seen him. I don't want to, you know, get into that. I mean, I didn't even look at the outs above average and the defense and all that stuff yet. So, all right, the pitching. And I think that's the part that, if you want to talk about June and the June swoon, and after the 12-game losing streak and maybe some of the stabilization that we saw in May, and why we didn't see the Mets creep back into near 500 and be part of the market, it's the pitching. Now, when you look at the pitching, you have the parts of the rotation that have been bad. The Kodai Sengas. When Peterson was here, I mean, let's face it, they were even going to the bulk games with these guys because they couldn't trust them, or they couldn't trust to get off to a good start at that point. You've got all these opener games that I hate. I hate opener games at this point. But you've had, and you've had struggles. The kids have struggled. The kids have struggled to give you depth. McClain and Scott. The big disappointment, having one of the worst years of his career, is Freddy Peralta, who I still think, with that arm angle, taking the drop that it is, there's something going on. I'm not saying there's an MRI now that says he's hurt. This is a check engine light. This is like your brakes not performing. This is like your car giving you signs that there's something not right. But it's still running. It's not running as well. But it'll just a bad day. No, there's something going on. Unless that arm angle is a mechanical thing that he just can't figure out, which the last time he had the same thing, he had shoulder issues, which is kind of funny. I don't know who's going to give him a long-term deal. I don't know what the Mets are going to do to get value from him. I am not of the mind that you should just give him away in a similar, again, going back to those Scherzer-Verlander deals from a few years ago. I think you're almost better off with the qualifying offer with him and seeing what you could do there. Especially if you're going to sign free agents, because you're going to lose. I mean, you're not going to lose your top 10 pick. We talked about that last week or the week before. But you're going to lose picks. And you saw already the Mets going into this draft that just happened, that if they didn't get their Edwin Diaz compensatory pick, they were kind of shut out early. Debate on how well they did. I have some thoughts, like I said, about that when we get to the mailbag. But when you start to break down, throwing all the BS aside of Peralta, Senga, Peterson, the short starts and the struggles and the developmental struggles of McClain and Holmes. The fact that they're arguably their best pitcher, McClain and Scott, arguably their best pitcher, Holmes, had a freak injury against his former club against during the Subway Series, broke his leg. The pitching has been or has the potential to be pretty good and was pretty good earlier in the year. Now, part of their success and the positives, they don't give up a lot of home runs. Their walk rate is solid. Their expected ERA and their expected FIP are within the top 12 in the sport. And that, to me, is positive. And if you want to go look even further, they're in the top 5 in ground ball rate. So there are parts of this roster on this staff that actually gives you reason to be hopeful. And these are the kind of things that the front office looks at. They don't read the newspaper and go, ah, this guy stinks, let's get him out. Like, that's not how you evaluate players. You have all this information in front of you. You have all this data in front of you. And yes, your eyes tell you A, B, and C. But McClain goes out there recently and he gives you decent starts. Scott goes out there and gives you decent starts. Andy Green talked about length being his developmental hurdle. And now Thornton joins the crew. And I know stuff-wise, he's not on the level of Scott and McClain. But he goes out there and it's almost like he puts the opposition to sleep. Now, his two best outings, the Phillies and the Red Sox, are not two of the better offensive teams in the sport. So I'd like to see, when he went up against a better offensive team in his debut, mind you, DC got himself in a little bit of trouble. I think the test for me with Thornton is, one, I always say go around the league a couple of times. Now they have a book on you. First time you could fool him. Let's see him against a good offensive team. Let's see him against good offensive team on the road. But a guy that profiles, and I know that the Davila looked a little bit higher. I saw a couple of 94s yesterday. It's usually 90 to 92. Something like that. To me, that is very, very encouraging. Now, there's a lot of chase going on with him, which is good. You can see how the hitters chase. I know you're not going to get a great metric of expected ERA. This is after I just told you expected batter, expected ERA. A guy that is a contact guy, a control guy, a command guy, a guy that it looks like is going to be about soft contact is probably similar. And we talked about this with David Peterson, never going to be sexy on the expected levels. But I think there's a value in the rotation. Now, I'm not suggesting Zach Thornton's an ace. I think he lands in what it looks like. He had a 4 ERA in the minors, a little over 4. But if you have yourself a young, controllable lefty that can give you innings and give you 6 innings, 3 runs, that to me is gold. Now, you won't ever see, and he might have those outings, we got to learn about him, where he gets pounded. He goes into a road start on a Sunday on a hot, humid day against a good offense and is command's a little off, and he's a little bit fat in the strike zone. You're going to have one of those 4-inning, 6-run games. It's probably going to mess up his overall numbers. I always talk about late-career Bartolo Colon. Never sexy numbers. Never sexy analytical numbers because he had stinkers in there. But he got the job done. That's okay. And maybe he settles into being a mid-rotation guy. Maybe he settles into being a better David Peterson, a better Steven Matz type player. Maybe that's what he settles into. There's a value there. And you could be going in, and then that brings me to Clay Holmes and the talk about him being open to an extension. Now, Clay Holmes last year was worth, if you look at advanced metrics, about $15 million. His performance. And before he got hurt, he was already on pace to be worth $9 to $10 million. This year. And he's in his early 30s. Now, he doesn't have a ton of miles on the arm, which may help him. And one of the things about Holmes, he's got one of the best ground ball rates in the sport. Probably contributes to what I just said with the Mets and their starting staff. If you're looking at a rotation, and right now, post August 3rd, your rotation is going to be at least McClain, Scott, and Thornton. You have those three. And don't discount, let's assume, and maybe they trade him. He's got about $20 million owed to him. Don't discount Manaea being that veteran that sticks around at least for another year and provides almost like that veteran. He's got $25 million he's due next year. Because since he went through that period where he looked awful, he looked like he was a modern-day Pedro Feliciano, he's got about a 3.75 ERA. There's a lot of six innings, two runs, six and change, three runs outings in there. And I know that you don't like all the time what you see, and he's a little home run prone, but a rotation, and let's say that they could figure out a way to bring Holmes back, who has, I think, a tremendous amount of upside. McLean, Scott, Thornton, Holmes, Manaea. Not bad. Couple of lefties, veteran in Holmes, two young upstart guys. You could probably get your innings from Holmes and Manaea. Now, there's questions about depth. That's where Weininger and Santucci and Tong and those guys, assuming none of them get traded, come into play. I'm not so sure, and I know that it'll be a conversation whenever the lockout ends or the strike ends or whatever. I'm not so sure, though, that Tarik Skubal's on the radar. And I don't know how, I mean, it seems like people still like playing here. The players like playing here, and that's all that matters. But how sellable is this environment and this program to free agents that want to settle in and be here? And if you're talking about giving a pitcher a seven-year big-time deal, you're looking at 7 years, $300 million for Skubal, when you have no idea how many injuries and decline there'll be and how much of a portion of the payroll that he's going to take up. I mean, that's going to happen post-lockout when you know the rules. So, I mean, I'm not counting on a big pitcher, a big-name pitcher. I think the rotation I just laid out. And don't discount that if Peralta continues this way, and let's assume maybe Mets, if they know he's hurt or they know it's trending that direction. And again, I'm speculating. At least I'm honest about what I'm speculating. I'm taking data and saying this, the last time he had this, there was something going on. I'm not saying he's going out for Tommy John or for shoulder surgery. There's something going on here. Because the last time his arm angle was at this point, there was something going on. But let's assume they say he's healthy, just having a bad year. I mean, you offer him the qualifying offer, was it $23 million? He may grab it and rebuild his value. Uncertainty may lead to the Mets. And then you have a rotation where you got six guys, you got a couple of kids. Three kids, actually, and three vets, Holmes, Peralta. That's not bad. That's not bad. And I know that Senga's still floating around here, but unless Senga could figure out how to be a one-inning reliever and a legit 3 out of 5 day one-inning reliever that could warm up quickly, I mean, after Kansas City and what I saw last week, I don't know what's left there. That might be a sunk cost. That's going into Oliver Perez territory now. They're going to have to do what Sandy Alderson did this last year, is just get him out of here. Unless he wants to go back to Japan. Don't be surprised that there's something going on in Japan. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to give up money. But that to me. So I think it makes a ton of sense not to trade Holmes, to sign him to an extension. I think you could look at 3 years with an option, maybe $60 million, maybe $20 million a year. Something like that. I wonder what, I mean, does he want to sign early? Because at his age, this is his shot. It's a terrible offseason for him to be opting out because of uncertainty. But he's a guy that I think would jump early because he's still reasonable. I think the big guys, I don't care what the rules are, pitchers are not going to, of Holmes' ilk, are not going to, you know, signed for $10 million. That was his last contract, coming off of being a closer, not knowing if the starting would go well, potentially being a bullpen piece, and that would have been a discount if the Mets had signed him to a closer bullpen piece. I think the conversation of putting him in the bullpen, even with concerns about Devin Williams as the closer, I think you could put those to bed. I think he's shown that he could start. Before he was getting hurt, he was starting to push himself into the sixth inning. I think the ultimate goal here with Holmes is if you get him signed to an extension, he has low mileage on his arm, so hopefully he'll be able to stay healthy on a 3 or 4 year deal. And maybe it's something like even Manaea, $25 million a year. I mean, the Manaea contract's a great comp. Maybe there's an option in there. Maybe even puts another player option in there after year three in case the world changes, the market changes, things like that. I think if you want to compete in 2027, the starting rotation is the key. It does not, and I'll go back. We could talk Lindor and Soto relationship, Lindor's decline, Ewing bench, David Williams, all that stuff. We could talk all that stuff. If the starting rotation is a mess, everything. You saw the bullpen come up aces this year for the under Stearns. And the offense has started to come around a little bit, even though there's still some brownouts since June, since you had Lindor and Soto back. And it still didn't matter. They still don't win. Because by and large, the pitching has been not great. And a lot of that even bleeds into the bullpen because of lack of length. The lack of length and the lack of quality at times. And Senga, Peterson, Peralta, biggest culprits of that. And yes, McClain and Scott have done their part. But even when they've been off, even when McClain's been off, he, for the most part, other than a couple outings, he's settled down and given you an okay outing. I mean, a couple of there, but I mean, okay outing. I mean, I think because he's not dominant, because he's not DeGrom, because he's not vintage Harvey, he gets held to a higher standard because of what we saw last August when he got called up. That's not fair. Maybe Scott's the better pitcher. We'll see. There's a lot to be hopeful for in this rotation. And Shamania quietly has been pretty good. Now, do you want to get that $25 million off the books and maybe reinvest into a better pitcher and sell at this point where maybe, because he's still, like you said, like I said, home run prone? I could see that. Him, Peralta. And I'm okay with that. I mean, how you fill out the rotation the rest of the summer, different ballgame. But if you're serious about contending in 27, and you don't know what you're going to get on these deals, unless you're getting a... I mean, I know Merrill Kelly got a top prospect from Texas last year. I always use that as the barometer. But unless you're getting somewhat of a top prospect that is not toolsy, but actually you think can translate well to some kind of contributing member of the big league roster. Not a Cunha or, you know, a lottery ticket or like a nice energy guy like Gilbert or a prodigious maybe power bat Clifford type. I wouldn't trade any of these guys. The relievers are a different story. I wouldn't just trade for the sake of trading. I mean, Sean Manaea is a decent pitcher if he's healthy. Now, maybe you're looking at Manaea, who led the staff in the OMG summer, but if you look at that Manaea, he wasn't the same in the postseason. I think the Manaea, the real Manaea, is a six inning and change, three run guy. 3.7. I think a guy with a 3.75 ERA, that's Manaea. I don't think he's an ace. I think he got hot there in the summer when he lowered his arm angle. And, I mean, even the Dodgers, he struggled a little bit against. That's no crime. A lot of people struggle against the Dodgers. And that's the Manaea that I think is real. So there's some hope there. Zach Thornton gave some hope. But it's more than Zach Thornton. We're going to be watching all these kids closely this summer. And I got to tell you, having Andy Green, who runs player development, and if he's anywhere near the honest straight shooter back doors that he is with the media. I mean, I really like Andy Green. I really like the way he talks. I mean, he talks my lingo. If he wanted to be the manager, I would tell you, forget the record with San Diego. And maybe there's more to him that we haven't seen. I'd love for him to be the guy. I think he could be a real... And obviously, that would be a hit on player development and maybe his value. Obviously, that's where he wants to be because of his family. But his value there could be incredibly important. But the kind of straight shooter baseball guy that you see with Green, type A personality, that's what this team needs. You know, whoever they bring in. And preferably somebody with experience like a Rob Thompson, maybe Alex Cora. I'm not so sure I'm into the Beltran / Pujols situation. Guys like that, former big leaguers that think they have leadership capabilities and want to get into the sauce here. So, all right, let's take a quick break. Mailbag, let's wrap up, talk a little bit about the draft, get to your questions, and I'm sure there'll be more right after this. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Mailbag. Let's see what we got going on. Let me start with the draft real quick. So here's what I'm going to tell you about the draft. I used to, back in the day, and I cannot remember his name, used to have a great guest, independent draft expert, scout. Like, he used to come on. This is going back 15 years ago, and I can't remember his name. Give great info. And we talk about players. And to this day, I don't remember ever having an accurate conversation about who's going to be great and who's not. And we look up and down prospect lists. And just remember, they're all lottery tickets. They're all accountable for their own personal development. Doesn't matter how good your coaching, your analytics department are. And makeup is going to be a big part of it. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means there's a lot of things between the ears and a lot of grind in this sport. Especially when you got guys potentially coming out of their senior prom and then jumping into an adulthood and a really tough adulthood job the day after they graduate. I mean, think about where you were at 18 and how hard that would be. So sometimes we have to put all that in mind. Nobody knows if this is a great draft. Nobody knows if it's a bad draft. If anybody tells you from any site or any Twitter account that the Mets had this guy sucks or this guy's great, they don't know. I don't care what Pipeline says. I don't care what Baseball America says. I don't care what MLB.com says. All they're giving you is information that's in the scouting, widely available scouting report, data that you have no idea the context of the games and how they were played, in what environments, against what level of competition. So if a guy had 25 home runs in college and struck out a lot, there's always going to be those concerns. Doesn't mean he's a power hitter. Doesn't mean he's going to come in and be your third baseman. Comps of high school players to major leaguers are silly because I think they're unfair. They put especially in this modern era where they put undue expectations in with fans, fickle fans. It used to be. And I think I even talked about this with Ryan Thompson a couple of weeks ago. You read Mets Inside Pitch newspaper, or you read the fine print after the draft in the Daily News or the Post back in the day about the Mets draft picks. You know, when you heard about Mets draft picks when it was something unique, like Elvis, the descendant of Elvis Presley, Kirk Presley, was drafted, or Mookie Wilson's stepson, Preston Wilson, was drafted. That made noteworthy news. Maybe if you had the first pick in the draft, like what the Mets had with Paul Wilson, that's different. Then they get some pub. I remember they compared Paul Wilson to Roger Clemens. How did that work out? So forget all that. Don't get all emotionally crazy. We are not the experts. The scouts who are trained are the experts. The front offices are the experts. And that's how it works. That's, you know, Chris Gross, Vice President of Amateur Scouting. He's highly respected from the Houston organization. And to me, that's the guy. That's why when I said you fire Stearns, you fire your President of Baseball Operations, you fire the entire philosophy. Now, if you don't like the philosophy, you think the philosophy is a losing philosophy, that's a completely different conversation. Completely different conversation. And, you know, that's a different type of thing. I mean, one thing, and Joe DiMeo over at SNY pointed this out, that Chris Gross with the Mets and the Astros, when he's overseen the drafts, it seems like he's always taken college hitters. This year they took a pitcher. Now, I'm not going to go and give you an analysis player by player, because you could read a lot of that. Looks like they took a lot of pitchers early, and a college bat early. They took bullpen arms in college that maybe they're going to try to turn into Christian Scott, or, you know, into a starter, and maybe they land as a decent bullpen arm. Just because they're a starter now or a bullpen arm now doesn't mean anything. They took some catchers. I mean, look, the positions that you see they targeted, guys that were catchers, guys that were middle infielders at shortstop, a couple outfielders, but basically pitchers and a power bat. That's what they value now. Going a little bit to what I was told. And take it with a grain of salt, but this is a professional take. So Aiden Robbins, he was a third round pick. One of the things I was told about him, outfielder at a University of Texas, has a routine, and maybe somebody that they had some concerns about putting in the work, profiles more as a corner outfielder, but he's got a good blend of strength and speed. So there you see right away, the makeup part is going to be big. Shane Sedejo, big-time athleticism and flexibility, lefty pitcher, high-ceiling arm, was throwing 96 pre-Tommy John surgery. Secondary pitches are average, but a strike throw. What was interesting, how he was described to me, was that he's a big-time competitor, maybe considered cocky, but again, a guy that, as you get out of being the big man on campus, is going to have to be looked at with his work. Now, the big pick, if you look, was Carson Wiggins. Tommy John surgery out of Arkansas. Not a lot of action because of the... and they probably got these guys under slot value a little bit. I think they were surprised. It sounds like the Mets were very surprised some of the availability of some of the players they got. Easy and fluid arm action with Wiggins. I like hearing that. A power arm. Big-time athlete, plus athlete. Can spin the slider. I think the Mets really like that. The real issue there is the command, and are the Mets going to be able to, with all that talent, get him to throw some strikes? Because it could be great to throw hard and have all this spin, but if you walk 10 per, nine innings, it doesn't matter at that point. And, so that's some of what I got, little tiny things, because I'm not going to sit here and act like I know what I'm talking about. Because I don't. The only other name on here that was Aiden Keenan. He was a 7th-round pick, and the guy that I spoke to had a lot of experience looking at him. High 90s fastball, but needs to develop secondary pitches. And I think that's what you're going to see throughout the draft. You're going to see the Mets take what essentially are toolsy guys and try to make something out of them. I mean, you look at this Aiden Robbins, a lot of power, and I saw some clips of power, but a lot of strikeouts to him. Local kid, too, played for Seton Hall for a couple of years. But there was actually some, especially at Seton Hall, I think there was one year he walked more than he struck out, because even in college ball, that's impressive. Now, as he developed power, and he went to Texas, that changed a little bit. He sacrificed some contact for power. At least the data said that. Again, I don't know because I didn't see the kid enough, and I don't know the context of the league. So there's some things about the draft. There's my couple of minutes about the draft. You go to the guys like DeMeo and all these other guys that do minor leagues. They might have better contacts, and they may dive into this deeper. But you don't know. It looks like the strategy was hard-throwing, mainly college relievers. They focused on pitching more than offense. They got themselves a power college bat. And then later in the draft, they went high school catchers, middle infielders, guys with athleticism that they could figure out and maybe convert. And I guess we'll see. This is not like the NBA and the NHL. You can't train. A lot of fans are going to treat it that way. You don't tank and get the number one pick and the guy comes in and he's Shaquille O'Neal and turns your franchise around. It's just not. It's not the way it works. He's not Victor Wembanyama. He's not... like when the Jets you thought you got Sam Darnold. He went and won a Super Bowl. So elsewhere, you got Sam Darnold. And all of a sudden, a quarterback's going to change your trajectory. So So there you go. All right, let's go to the mailbag. Let's see what you guys got. Keith writes, Mike, some of the stupidest challenges and plays that I've seen are made by the baby Mets led by Vientos and Alvarez. Even some of the pitchers signed or drafted by previous Mets front offices, I question their pitch choices and defensive coverage. I've noticed a difference in the baseball IQ and instincts of the players that Stearns has drafted or promoted through the system. McClain, Ben, Ewing, and Scott are not just great athletes, but they have the instincts and sports intelligence to make good plays and decisions on the field. For me, the most frustrating part of watching this season is not the losing, but the stupid decisions and plays that make the losses that much worse. There's no excuse for these type of plays, decisions, and selfishness. Ugh. Andy Green talked about this, Keith, about execution. He was very blunt. He didn't hold back. Very blunt. And I agree with this, and I don't know if it's a prior regime or baby Mets or those personalities of those guys. I think sometimes, and I even saw it with A.J. Ewing over the weekend when he got caught with a couple of runners on Saturday afternoon where he challenged, and he's got a good eye, he challenged a strike that I got to tell you, and I think it was either the seventh or the eighth inning he struck out looking with runners on. I think that was in frustration. I really do. And the problem with the ABS, particularly, is that it's controlled by the players. Now, in the NBA, only the bench can signal for a challenge. If you allowed players the kind of leeway to make challenges in the NBA that you did with this ABS, I mean, teams would blow challenges. They're very strategic in the NBA. It's a big part of that. And you really can't do that with the ABS. Personally, what I've seen of the ABS now through half a season plus, just convert it over. I know you're taking away the umpire's ability to throw call balls and strikes. And maybe that, but it's never fails. I mean, the stuff that they fail on the umpires, there's some egregious way out of the zone, but very rare. It's on the minuscule corner. The human eye can't do what that kind of technology does. I'm amazed. The only problem is if it fails, can the umpire still be trained enough to call balls and strikes? I think that that's something they can't take away. They still have to call balls. You know, it's got to be some way. You know, maybe there's the home plate, and I think this has been brought up. I don't know if it was brought up on the broadcast or somewhere I heard about it. That they become home plate umpires. Like, you don't have them rotate. You focus on specializing on the bases and other rules. But the technology is so good. Why bother even having the challenge system? Just go to it. You have a clean strike zone. You have a clean game. The strike zone, as it was written in the rule book back in the day, the technology's there. It hasn't failed. There's never been a AI, we'll call them, ABS strike that I've seen. At least me, you tell me if you've seen it, that I said, oh, that system stinks. That's because I remember when it first came out, there was like reports from like the Atlantic League where if the ball crossed a certain, even though it was way low, it was catching it. Like it does, they've figured this thing out. They really have. I mean, in the world of AI, I got to think that you can figure this kind of stuff out. So, you know, that to me is part of it. All right, let's see what else we got here. I know that as the season goes on and as we get deeper, I wonder, hopefully you guys are still going to be listening, still be engaged. I know I'm worried about losing a lot of people after the trade deadline because I know as the summer goes on, that, you know, this is not what you wanted to spend your summer doing, being aggravated. But with the kids, I think that we may not see as much of that as I originally thought. Mitch writes, Mike, I've seen that Luis Robert is nearing the end of his rehab assignment and will be activated soon. Where is there room for him on the current 26-man roster? Where will he play when he's activated? Does David Stearns intend to sit the rookies? I do not believe the rookies will sit. I don't know where Luis Robert fits. Maybe DH. Maybe he'll sit against a tough lefty, Ewing, or probably more so Ewing than Bench. Maybe he plays a corner outfield spot, which our friend David Mills has been talking to me about for all year because he said he's not a great center fielder. A corner outfield spot, and Soto will DH. I don't think they pick up his option, and I think that the back issue he has, which I believe is lumbar, is a very tricky thing. I don't know if I'd opt into that $20 million. He'd have to show me a lot of power the last 2 months. I don't think it's a bad thing to see what's left out of him. I mean, you're not going to be able to trade him because there's not enough time unless he comes back and rakes for 2 weeks. And even then, I don't know what you would get. But I just think Luis Robert was a lottery ticket signing. Didn't cost you. Acuna was a prospect that didn't pan out. Last I looked, he wasn't doing much in Chicago. Has some good versatility and speed for the bench. Nothing that I think you can't find. And certainly nothing that you would cry giving up in the event that Robert had his 30 home run season. But with Benj and Ewing, I don't see a fit there unless it's in a corner or DH. And they could use a bat. I mean, let's face it. Polanco, we don't know his health status. So maybe he could be a bat that could help. And he was showing some signs of being a halfway decent bat early. But we didn't get to see him enough to really evaluate that. Look, if your concern is that the Mets are going to be forced to play him because of his salary at the expense of the kids, the rest of the season is about the kids. It's about Benj, Ewing, McClain, Scott, Thornton. I mean, you got to be impressed. Since August of last year, the Mets have promoted McClain, impactful player, Ewing, impactful player, Benj, impactful player, and Thornton, we don't know if he's impactful, but he's useful. At the very least, I think he's useful back end of the rotation at a reasonable cost when now back end of the rotation pitchers cost you $20 million a year, $15 to $20 million a year. Think about that. And that's in a calendar year, not a calendar year, from August to August. I don't think a lot of teams are doing that. Now, I know it's been a bad stretch since June of last year, but that's positive. And you want to throw Scott in, and I know he came up in 24, but he's been developed, and he seems to be emerging. I think that's a really positive thing. Joe writes, what do you think the Mets should do regarding Weaver? Should they take a stance where they only trade him if they get a very high prospect in return? I would hate to lose a guy that is under team control for another year, that has pitched so well, he could be their closer, but at the same time, relievers can also be volatile from year to year, and would hate to pass up on getting some good prospects. So here's what I would say, Joe. Thanks. Great question. I think Minter, rarely. I don't think they're going to trade Williams, but I would listen. Weaver, even Brazenban, who's under team control, I think that you listen and you see what kind of haul. And I we're going to say this for the billionth time, and you're going to go and roll your eyes. Is there a Jeff Bagwell for Larry Anderson trade for these guys out there? I would not just give them away. Now, Raley and Minter are free agents. That's different. But Brazenban, Weaver, Williams, and I'm putting Williams in there just because he's controllable. There's never been an indication that there's interest or that he's being traded. There's been some indication about Brazenban and Weaver. If you get yourself a very useful piece that can contribute, I think, or be a top prospect, you have to listen. I think Weaver could be emerging and finally figuring this thing out. He was good with the Yankees. He had some struggles. Sounds like it wasn't New York-itis. It sounds like it was more mechanics. This is a former top prospect that was supposed to be a good top of the rotation starting pitcher. There's baseball chops in him. I like his moxie. I think if you want to compete in 27, you need guys like that. I agree he could be the closer. I don't know what the future Devin Williams is, but maybe the Mets got themselves a low-cost closer. I've been a critic of Brazenban. He's shown me a lot this year, a lot, and he's under control. Why give those pieces away if you intend to compete in 27 unless you get something that is really valuable? Now, here's what's going to happen. If the Mets are not active in tearing the thing down, and they only trade like the Raley, the Minter, maybe a few other, Peralta, the obvious guys, and they keep the band together, they're going to get torched by the media. The media wants to see a teardown. The media wants to see gifting of the players to their favorite teams. The media wants a Mets team in rebuild. So they're going to get criticized no matter what they do. And if they do wind up trading all these guys, like the media wants, they'll get criticized for the return and that now Steve Cohen has a mess on his hands. So the Mets aren't going to win here in the media's eyes. What the Mets can do is do what's right for a team to balance what the good reporting has been since the start, the good reporters. They should balance the difference between selling assets and tearing down and having the beginning of the foundation for 27 and then we see what this looks like going into what I will call the end of the year extended spring training. So there's that. So we're going to end on that note. Hope you enjoyed this show. We are now at the All-Star break. What's next? I definitely think we need to start looking at the farm system again. I'll be talking to my buddy David Mills, and I know he does a back half of the year report, and we'll talk a little bit about that with him. I know you guys have asked to get him back on the show. I'm sure our buddy Ernie Dove, a good friend of the show, he'll be part of the conversation later in the summer. I always like to get him on. You guys ask for him a lot. So I do listen to the public, even though this is my show and I call the shots, and I am a friendly dictator, so to speak. I do understand and listen to what you guys want, and I know what good contributors are there out there, and sometimes you don't want to just hear me. I know that we will get into the 86 celebration, and I'm going to take a different take on that. I'll hold off on getting into that today. I'll hold off on that, and I know Beltran's number is going to be retired, so there's some things to talk about. I always find that the history of the Mets is something that, as time goes on, that is not resonating as much with the fans, the former players, things like that. I don't know if it's because of the ranting on analytics or the fact that it's been out there so long, or maybe the fact that it's been 40 years since the last championship and people are tired of hearing about it. And as somebody who just saw the Knicks break a similar type of drought, plus 13, I get it. You want to move on with the new. But like I told you, when this thing is, and it's going to get good, and the Mets are going to win a title, it's going to be fabulous, because take it from somebody, if you're not a Knicks fan and you didn't experience what I just experienced last month, it's beautiful. It's fun. It's beautiful. And you'll remember it for the rest of your life. And it's going to be the stress will be one thing, but the week after will be one of the best sports weeks you'll ever have in your life. So anyway, leave on that. We'll be back with another edition of the Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, of course, check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X, at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join me at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your All-Star break. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.